I'm thrilled to be here to interview a personal hero of mine, Nicholas Kristof. He's done so much, and I look up to him for so many reasons. One particular story that always stands out to me, back in 2007, Nick wrote an article in the New York Times on a small loan that he made on Kiva to a baker in Afghanistan. I wrote down banker, but it's baker. And he later went on to meet that baker and tasted the 12-cent loaves of bread that he had helped fund. He gave so much humanity to Kiva and attention to it in the very early stages, and I'll be forever personally grateful for that. But I know that probably everybody in this room is here because there's been some insight that you've gained from his writing and his reporting, some argument he's made that's changed how you think or feel about service and purpose and possibility in the world. And I bet that for everybody here, you have a personal story too, of something that's touched you or changed you. So we are all in your debt. I'm sure we're all grateful and excited for time with you tonight. Nick is here tonight specifically for his latest book, A Path Appears, also quite beloved already for me, and which it will also air as a PBS documentary in January, so keep an eye out for that. And without further ado, please join me in welcoming to the stage two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. I wanted to start with this. You acknowledge in your book that a lot of people you've seen feel paralyzed in the face of huge social problems. Why don't you?
You know, I think because I have, in the course of my time reporting, I've seen real progress. When I first began traveling around Africa in 1982, the thing that really struck me was the blindness. There were so many middle-aged people who were unnecessarily blind, of river blindness or trachoma, or cataracts, and these days that is much less true. Jimmy Carter made tremendous progress against river blindness, and cataracts can be resolved for surgery, often costing less than $100. Trachoma may be just about the most painful way to go blind. One woman we quote in the book describes it as like the pain of childbirth day in, day out, year in, year out. And she...
Too close to home.
Yes. Sorry. Remind me to be careful of my metaphors.
Watch it.
Because she was blind, she was unable to farm her land, and some of her children had died as a result. So it was much more than blindness. And then she got a $40 surgery through Helen Keller International. $40 by this nurse. Took 20 minutes, and it, you know, completely transformed her life and her family's. And to see that happen, that reminds you of our capacity to make a difference, not to resolve the problem of blindness globally. You know, I think we sometimes think that to make a difference, we have to solve a problem. We're not going to solve a problem, but we can quite easily take steps that are transformative for other people. And that is incredibly empowering, not only of those other people, but of ourselves, too. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. One of the things that I appreciated so much about this book was that you tell, obviously, some amazing stories about individuals who've had these transformational changes, who have often lifted themselves up with just a little bit of help, a little bit of intervention from a great organization or an individual's generosity. And you tell stories of organizations that are not the usual suspects. Not all of them are the usual suspects in the social sector. You talk about organizations that have been overlooked because they're small or just not sexy enough, or often because they're brand new and you admit freely, you know, hey, we don't know if this is going to succeed. This might not make it. I love that you did that. And I think with a lot of nonprofits, I mean, you also mentioned that while shareholders reward corporations for taking risk, in the nonprofit sector it's very different and they're held to a different standard. Can you talk a little bit about what you think nonprofits in particular, a nonprofit's role is in taking risks and pushing things forward and in innovating? Seems like there's a unique opportunity there that I might be reading into, but that you're trying to highlight.
I mean, you know, I think there's sort of a broader problem we face, which is that it's kind of silly, frankly, that, you know, a lot of families will take one pool of money and they will invest that in the stock market, mm-hmm. and for that they don't care about social return, but they want a maximum possible financial return. Mm-hmm. And then they take another pool of money, sort of the charitable money, and they entirely give that away, and they want zero return. They don't want to preserve their capital at all. And it's this incredible bifurcation, while, in fact, the world, you know, is more complicated. You can't, the old way of thinking was to divide the world into corporations, you know, evil, and nonprofits, noble. And obviously, it's much more complicated than that. There are plenty of nonprofits that don't actually achieve very much, and there are some corporations that have quite a good impact. And I think that if we can figure out ways of not having this stark bifurcation, but acknowledge that, you know, maybe we want to invest some money and get a smaller return, but also have a positive social impact in a way that is more sustainable, or maybe get our capital back, but not the interest, or the move toward companies that are double bottom line or triple bottom line. You know, I think that we're kind of on the cusp of a new ways of having an impact that is much more sophisticated than the old division, and that will, I hope, infuse the nonprofit sector with a lot of new ideas and new ways of doing things.
What do you think would have to happen to free nonprofits to do that more? Is it just much more enlightened donors that have, you know, that explicitly give permission to organizations to take risks and to fail? I mean, I also really appreciated that you mentioned some failures in the sector, yeah. Although they were great social experiments and we've all learned a lot from them.
I mean, one of the basic problems is that we demand all kinds of unreasonable things from nonprofits, and those constrain them. And people, I mean, donors have been kind of trained to look at Charity Navigator or other sites and really look very, very closely at some of these financial ratios. And in one sense, that's useful. I mean, you don't want to donate to a charity that is, you know, spending its money building the most glorious marble lobby for itself. But on the other hand, really what you want is impact. And those financial ratios don't determine impact. And so, one of the problems with that stress on those ratios is that often nonprofits underinvest in their people, underinvest in IT, underinvest in training, and sometimes don't pay people enough to retain and to hire and retain the best people. And so I think that there needs to be something of a revolution on the part of us donors, and, you know, to accept more risk, to focus more on impact and acknowledge that, you know, ratios, that if money is spent in administration, that's not a waste. That can indeed help advance the cause.
Yeah. You also say that a lot of nonprofits underinvest in marketing, for example. You bring up that thought, that idea, right? And there were three things, maybe I'm linking them incorrectly here, but three things that I think are so fascinating and memorable. You talked about how thinking logically can impair giving. There's research that shows that if the rational side of our brain is activated, the moral feelings that we might have that could lead us to donate on the spot might be held back or impaired or muted. Talk about that. You had a crazy statistic or an anecdote in there about how men are more generous to a charity when they're asked by an attractive woman. And in fact, the more attractive they perceive the woman to be, the more they'll give. I'm just leaving that out there for people. And then you did talk about Brian Mulaney, Dan Pelota, Brian Mulaney of Smile Train, and Dan Pelota or Pelota, whose TED Talk about charity being dead wrong went viral at least a number of months ago, if not earlier. And there was an example you brought up about how some people might argue that using pictures, I'm kind of quoting here, of a white boy to raise money that goes overwhelmingly to kids in Africa is misleading, but as long as the charity is sticking to its mission and showing results, then selling a cause is also important. Can you talk a little bit about this tension between wanting donors to be more educated and more active and more rational and thoughtful about their giving, but also knowing that sometimes, you know, the people designing marketing campaigns know these tricks, know these things about what gets people to give, and it might not always be use your brain more. That was a long question.
This is broadly speaking, this is an issue that I became interested in when I was writing about Darfur, and it felt as if I was going there and these columns about Darfur were just kind of sinking without a ripple. And at the same time, it was incredibly frustrating because those of you who traveled to New York, you may remember that at that same time in 2004, there were these two red-tailed hawks living in Central Park, a pale male and his wife, I forget what her name was, they had been kicked out of their nest in an apartment building right next to Central Park. And New York was all up in arms and so indignant about these two homeless red-tailed hawks. And I thought, how is it that I can't generate as much outrage about hundreds of thousands of people being killed as New Yorkers feel about two homeless red-tailed hawks? And so that led me to the work of some social psychologists who look at this question of what generates empathy, what engages us with a cause. And that's what led me to this question of rationality. And it turns out that, you know, that basically we in journalism and we in the humanitarian world, if you will, do everything exactly wrong. You know, one thing is we talk about the scale of the challenge. There are X million people suffering from this, you know. And in fact, the larger the number we talk about, the less inclined people are to give. And in fact, the number at which engagement diminishes is when N goes from 1 to 2, the moment you have more than one. It's about individual stories. It's about an individual picture. It's about emotional pathways. And as Jessica said, if you ask people to do math problems first so that the more rational side of their brain is activated, then they donate less. Really pretty sobering. And so part of it is this storytelling, this sort of emotional pathway to open up channels of empathy. And the other is that there has to be some arc of hope and possibility. And so if you just present all the problems all the time, then people just become overwhelmed and think it's hopeless and they don't see that they're going to have an impact. So you have to present the problem, but also show that there can be a better outcome if people engage. And in that, if you do those things, open up with an individual story and some possibility of hope, then I think one can. And I think that, you know, often people who care deeply about these issues don't adopt those tools and do the opposite, talk about large numbers of people and make it all sound pretty despairing. And on the question of marketing, you know, I think a lot of humanitarians flinch at the idea of marketing. You know, that's what Coca-Cola does. It is so much more important to market bed nets or clean water or vaccines, which are potentially life-saving, than it is. You know, I don't care whether Coke managed to market well. I really care whether clean water gets marketed in a way that lives can be saved.
Yeah. Well, what about this, the identifiable victim effect that you just talked about? So I think we all kind of know this at a gut level, that stories move us, and stories of an individual person, not two but one person, are especially resonant. But and the Stalin said it maybe quote of a single death is a tragedy, a million is a statistic. So profiling individuals versus having a poster child works, right? And real individuals, not just an example story. This is becoming the norm now, and it's really exciting to see. Do you worry about a saturation effect? And if and when that happens, I mean, do these stories ever add up to be sort of a group, to be a statistic, and we get numb? We start to expect that we know the story, and they don't become as special. What is the cure for that?
I don't think I worry so much about that as such. I do worry that we invariably tend to over-donate to anything that you can put a face on or a name on. Mm-hmm. I do think that, I mean, universities have figured out how to sell the same thing about 10 times over. So you have the, you know, the Bill Smith wing or the Bill Smith room and the Joe Jones wing of the such and such building, and the such and such professor walks in it. And, you know, I think that's very clever. I think that nonprofits are figuring out better how to do do something similar with kind of naming opportunities. But there are so many incredibly important interventions that don't slice and dice very well.
Right.
And so anything that you can put a name on gets overinvested, and anything you can't really slice and dice gets underinvested in. And there is clearly kind of a market failure there. But I guess I don't worry about that this will just numb people, because one of the fascinating things that Cheryl and I learned in working on the book is that the richest 20% of people in America actually donate less to charity than the poorest 20%. And that seems to be not because affluent people are intrinsically not empathetic or helpful, but it's just that if you were affluent, you managed to insulate yourself from need. You live in, you know, some nice neighborhood where your neighbors aren't particularly needy. You don't encounter it, and so you don't respond. Well, if you were poor in America, every day you see people who are poorer than you and needier than you, and so you respond and you give. I do think that some of these kinds of connections become a way to remind the affluent of needs out there, mm-hmm. and to connect them to those needs, and are a way of kind of a circuit breaker to break through that insulation that we construct around ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Great. I'm not really worried about saturation too, but I've heard that argument and thought you might have a good take on it. You mentioned Cheryl. It's a bummer she can't be here tonight, as your co-author and your very significant other. What would she say it's like to work with you?
Mm. I wonder if she's watching this now.
I know.
Oh, my cell phone's ringing. It's Cheryl.
That would be great. Speakerphone.
First of all, Cheryl sends her regrets about not being here. Our youngest, is a high school senior, and if we traveled together on this book tour, our daughter would have the most amazing parties at her house. So it seemed more prudent to, you know, to divide.
Risk mitigation.
You know, there is this slight burden in the family when you have this reputation of being a sensitive man, the feminist, and the guy who's was thinking that you know, whenever the garbage needs taken out, it's sort of, you know, who does it fall to? Well, where is that sensitive man? You know, what happened to him?
And this guy taking garbage out.
But I must say, we've had this sort of amazing partnership, and people always ask how we manage to write books together and stay married. And the truth is that if you can raise three kids together and stay married, a book is a piece of cake, yeah. You know?
I'd agree.
You can put a book to bed at night and it stays asleep. A book doesn't play you off each other. And if you totally screw up on a book, you know, the stakes are lower. So,
great answer.
So it's been really a wonderful partnership.
I love it. You mentioned your 17-year-old, 18-year-old?
Just turned 17.
In the book, you talked about how it's really exciting to see a lot of young people see a path in social entrepreneurship as a possible career, but that perhaps one of the challenges of the state of social entrepreneurship right now is that a lot of young people equate success with being a founder. And you said, you know, we need more entrepreneurs. We need more people who can go into an existing organization or government and say, I'm going to change it from the inside out. How do you make this happen? Is it something that corporations should take on and create new roles to sort of honor the entrepreneurs? Do we need a public campaign against the cult of the founder? What do you think is the trick there?
You know, I think that sort of social norms have to change. And there is a bit of a problem right now that everybody wants to found something, and so we have this incredible multiplicity of tiny organizations that don't scale up, and then after a few years, often the founder will lose interest, move on. In the corporate sector, that's solved with M&A, but in the nonprofit sector, we don't really have M&A. So I think...
Should we?
I think we should.
Yeah.
Oh, I think there should be... I really think it'd be wonderful if there were more M&A in the nonprofit sector, and some of these organizations that have kind of foundered a little bit, that if they merged with others and their mailing lists and donor lists were absorbed, I think that would be fabulous.
You have so many stories, you've seen so much. Can you talk about some of the most exciting, again, perhaps overlooked, disruptive innovations that you've seen in the social sector, whether at an organization level or a technology level?
And one cool innovation that that I liked. It has to do with a great Father's Day present that I got.
The little rat.
They're hero rats. Yeah, yeah.
This is a great story. Please.
So there are these giant Gambian pouched rats that live quite long and have a brilliant sense of smell, and so they've been trained to sniff out landmines, and they're used in both Angola and Mozambique, and they walk across minefields and they don't set them off because they're too light, and they sniff a mine and then people can clear it. And so in 2 hours, one of these hero rats can clear more land than a human deminer can in 2 days. And so a organization called Apopo lets you sponsor the education of a rat for, I think, about $50 or so. And so my kids, 1 year for Father's Day, got me a hero rat in my name. And... what a macho present, big rat. So much better than a necktie. I thought that was both something innovative in the field and also clever marketing that really can make a global difference.
Could you talk a little bit about the role of media, social media, traditional media, to bring attention to these important issues that you have brought so much to?
This is actually something that kind of scares me a little bit and troubles me as a journalist. I think that we in the mainstream news media are increasingly going to be dropping the ball on all kinds of important issues. Global health, nutrition, global poverty, and domestic poverty. And that's because traditionally, I don't think we ever did a great job covering these issues, but there was at least some sense of responsibility that these are issues we should cover. These days, the business model for traditional news media has collapsed. Television especially is desperate for viewers, and viewers are not so interested in these kinds of stories. If you're an executive producer of a program, you can send somebody off on some global story, and it's incredibly expensive, and then your ratings will drop compared to your rival, who just put a Democrat and a Republican in a little studio together and have them yell at each other. And I find that very depressing. The Gates Foundation had to try to deal with this, business model collapse, essentially bribed ABC News a couple of years ago to cover global health and nutrition issues. And it was called a grant, but, this was controversial in the development community, because here the Gates Foundation is taking money that could be used for delivery of services to some of the world's neediest people, and instead it's giving it to overpaid television executives to do what they should be doing anyway. So it was controversial. And though in that year, ABC News really did some good stories. They did stories about maternal health, maternal mortality. They did stories about vitamin A deficiency, about nutrition. And it elevated those issues in the national agenda, which is certainly one step to dealing with them. And then at the end of the year, Gates Foundation decided, okay, this is working. Let's renew it. Let's pay another annual bribe. And ABC News said, no, we don't want to do this again, because they can see from their audience metrics that those are the moments when viewers are turning the channel, going to the bathroom, whatever. And I found that so dispiriting. And if we can't figure out how to cover some of these issues in a way that audiences will relate to and tune to, then these issues are going to drop off the map. And these will have real consequences for addressing them. The whole international community dropped the ball on Ebola. Here you have an infectious disease that started at the end of 2013, and it was really only in around August that people began to take it seriously. Well, if journalists had been covering this aggressively right from the beginning, if this had been on TV in nightly newscasts all along, I think that there would have been pressure to address it earlier. That would have saved money and saved lives. But that, I think, is just not going to happen in this new paradigm for television coverage in particular. And so that means we have to find other ways to fill that vacuum. And, you know, there are a lot of smart people in San Francisco who know social media, who understand new platforms. I'm hoping that to some degree social media can fill that vacuum and can make some stories go viral or call attention to these issues. I mean, to some extent, that happened with the missing Nigerian schoolgirls. That garnered international attention in part through Twitter. But we've got to figure out a way to fill the gaps that increasingly are going to be filled by those of us in the mainstream media dropping the ball.
I actually heard an interview earlier today on NPR where you were asked, are you a man of faith? And you started to discuss the God gulf you bring up in the book, and meaning the difficulties that exist, the chasm that exists between people of faith, people who do not ascribe to a particular religious institution or faith experience. And I find this a really interesting and really resonant, important issue. I'm married to a very loud, outspoken, and quite dashing Muslim man. He's right there. and I was raised Christian. Our life together, our family, is sort of this ongoing exercise and expression of interfaith action. And besides marrying the person and falling in love and marrying them, which is totally effective but not scalable, what have you seen? What works best to bring people of different, just sets of values even, but certainly different faiths together to do good in the world?
I mean, one of my big frustrations is that there are so many issues where actually the secular community and the faith community are both doing good work on it, but because of the polarization in the U.S. and the incredible, and this God gulf, they don't cooperate and so accomplish much less than they would otherwise. And sex trafficking is, you know, a great example of that. It's an incredibly important issue. Secular feminists are doing very good work on it. Evangelical Christians are doing good work. There are areas where they disagree, but there's huge commonality. I mean, everybody agrees that 16-year-old girls shouldn't be out on the street and the police shouldn't be arresting them. They should be arresting the pimps. And yet, it's so hard to generate that cooperation and to put the pressure on prosecutors, on police, on city officials. I think, again, that just has to come ultimately from you know, from both constituencies to kind of hold their nose and reach out and build practical partnerships to get things they care about done. If one doesn't do that, then the losers are those, you know, the voiceless out there on these issues who just aren't getting attention. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that struck us, Cheryl and me, when we were working on the book is that the secular world traditionally has kind of made giving sort of this solitary activity and often perceived as sort of a sacrifice, while especially the megachurches make it this joyous social activity. And I really think there's something, I think that's a pretty clever approach that the secular world should adopt. And indeed, we write about some organizations like Dining for Women or Bead for Life, sort of groups of, often it's women, but it wouldn't have to be, you know, who get together and...
Isn't there a beer one that you said men...
Beer for books?
Beer for books,
yeah, that's
there you
go. That's the male equivalent. but, you know, things that embody a certain amount of fellowship in some sense, in a very secular way, with some sense of giving back, of some larger cause. And to me, that feels a little bit like a secular version of what the megachurches are doing in creating a social giving community.
Yes.
And I wonder if that isn't going to happen a lot more.
You mentioned a few surprising links in the book I just found so intriguing and sort of delightful to hear about, like how perhaps the intended effect of deworming kids was one thing, but there's a link to literacy later in life. Are there any other links that you can highlight for us that are surprising and unexpected and maybe seem to be several steps removed? Or, maybe better, do you have any hypotheses about links that exist out there, unexpected links between one intervention and an effect later on that maybe haven't been proven out yet, but you kind of have a hunch will be proven at some point.
One thing that I found fascinating that sort of goes to that has to do with something that is hard to talk about, which is self-destructive behaviors. And this is something that in my reporting I've seen just, you know, all the time, that families don't have enough money for a bed net to protect against malaria, but the dad is going off 3 times a week to buy banana beer. And
not with the group that then gives the money to... Sorry. Maybe too much, sorry.
Globally as just a ballpark figure, it seems that families earning less than $2 a day globally are spending about 10 times as much on a combination of alcohol, tobacco, sugary drinks, prostitution, and very extravagant festivals as they are on education, which is for their kids, which is a great investment. And so, you know, how do you address the sort of self-destructive behaviors, whether it's abroad or at home? And I think that we now have pretty good evidence that some of these come from a sense of hopelessness and despair that sometimes is actually clinical depression, and that in any case becomes self-fulfilling, that people feel that they just can't escape this rut that they're in. They self-medicate, and then that despair becomes self-fulfilling, and often for the next generation, self-replicating. So how does one break that cycle? I think that there's a scholar at MIT, Esther DeFlo, did some fascinating work on an organization that gave gifts of cows. It was an offshoot of a program by BRAC, the Bangladeshi organization. And it surprised her that this gift of a cow turned out to have a much greater impact on reducing poverty than made sense. That not only did the family earn more money on livestock income, which would make sense, but also on their family plot, family garden plot, on odd jobs they earned. And it turned out, essentially, that these families had kind of just given up. And then once they got this gift of a cow, they suddenly foresaw that maybe they could live a better life, and maybe their children could go on to high school and could live a... could do more. And so then they began working many more hours in their private plot. They spent less money on temptation goods. They worked more in odd jobs. And I wonder if one of the reasons why a lot of interventions end up working domestically or abroad is not because of the nature of that intervention itself, but because the recipient suddenly has this new sense of possibility. And that in turn is in part what is transformative by empowering that individual.
You talk about the importance of mentorship. Early on in your own life and career, did you have mentors that helped inspire you to take your career to this incredible level and to pursue what you loved?
I got to say my parents were incredible mentors and pushers, and some wonderful journalists who pointed me in this way. But really what I think for both Cheryl and me, what really moved us in this direction was the people we interviewed. And then when it becomes, when you see these stories and these people, I started out as an economics reporter writing about international economics and debt and exchange rates. And I thought I was going to write one story about kids being prostituted back in 1996 in Cambodia, and I saw these little girls who had been kidnapped and were being sold, and realized that this was just like 19th century slavery, except they were going to be dead of AIDS by their early 20s. And it's really hard to spend a day with them and write a story and then go back to writing about exchange rates.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, Darfur, I thought I'd write one piece, and then you talk to these incredible people struggling along, and they haunt you. So in that sense, my mentors are some amazing people that I've had the privilege of spotlighting in my column.
I love it. Which comes first, happiness or altruism?
One of the things that is kind of fascinating is that we often start off with altruism by, you know, trying to help other people. And there's this abundant evidence we end up helping ourselves. And my favorite correlation was that not only does it make us happier, it makes us healthier. And one study looked at mortality rates for seniors, and it found that if you joined a church, your mortality risk dropped 29%. If you exercise several times a week, your mortality risk drops 30%. If you volunteer several times a week, it drops 44%. And then, you know, the obvious conclusion is that if you just volunteer for a religious running organization, you live forever, you know?
Perfect.
But there, and the research is overwhelming about the benefits to oneself emotionally and physiologically from pro-social behavior.
Wonderful. If you could give everyone one book, everyone in the world in their own language, one book, and it can't be ones that you've written, what would it be?
There was a brilliant book written a few years ago by Lawrence Cass and Claudia Golden at Harvard called The Race Between Education and Technology, which argued that the reason that the U.S. had risen to global economic preeminence was essentially that we focused on mass education beginning in the 19th century. We were the first country to have close to universal literacy, then the first country to send many, many people to high school, then the first to make tertiary education very widespread. And that laid the groundwork for our economic development, that Europe was better in elite education, we were better in mass education. And they argued very compellingly. And you know, unfortunately, though, since about 1970, so many other countries have eclipsed us in mass education, in high school graduation rates and tertiary education rates, and especially in the working class in America, there's no longer a sense that a kid is going to get a better education than their parents. And I think that that is something that compromises not only the future of those kids, but of our country as a whole.
What do you think sets Americans apart, if anything, for better or for worse, from other people and other cultures that you've encountered?
We understand that everybody can understand English if it's spoken loudly enough.
It's a secret.
That partly compensates for our linguistic challenges.
Okay, favorite cause that maybe is a little bit off center of serving the needy?
I'd say wilderness. I'm a very enthusiastic backpacker. I think that it's incredibly important that we not only preserve wilderness, but that we also figure out ways of getting people into it, to see the therapy of being in the cathedral of the wilderness.
You mentioned how to increase marketing to increase levels of aid. And obviously, Ebola is something that's on many hearts and minds in this audience right now. And I read a report recently that basically said that incidents, rather than epidemics, are more likely to receive aid. In other words, 9/11 and the Haiti earthquake received incredible amounts of aid, whereas famine and other epidemics have a hard time pulling in the kind of numbers that they need to really address these issues. And therefore, aid becomes kind of reactive rather than preventive. I was wondering if you would agree with this as an issue, and how can we address this? Because Ebola is going to be a very hard problem to solve increasingly, and we can nip it in the bud as early as possible with aid, but the aid's not going to come until it becomes an incident level. So what do we do with this dynamic, and how do we get the aid there that we need?
It's a good question. You know, the basic problem is that we in the news media cover what happens today. We don't cover what happens every day. And the things that happen every day, by definition, aren't news. So, well, 17,000 kids died today before the age of five of mostly preventable diseases, malaria and diarrhea, this kind of thing. And because that's not news, those issues tend to get under-addressed. And, well, if there is an earthquake, then, you know, we're all over it. And I think that that's partly our responsibility, and that we need to figure out better ways of reminding the public about these perennial challenges, and that in turn drives drives money to them. But it's an uphill struggle because, again, if you're a television executive producer, then if you cover an earthquake, people will tune in. If you cover malaria, people will switch the channel. That's the challenge we face, and that's where, to some extent, the public and social media can perhaps address some of these things.
What do you think of things like B Corps and trying to push companies to at least have some sort of B Corp presence?
I think B Corps are a great idea. I mean, B Corps are this sort of hybrid in between companies and in between, you know, traditional profit maximizing companies and nonprofits. And I think that they are a really good idea. I must say that the market doesn't seem to embrace them very much, and investors seem suspicious of the idea of something that isn't completely profit maximizing. But I'm a believer, and Cheryl is what she's doing now is basically trying to raise money for startups, in especially those that have a social mission, a double bottom line, triple bottom line companies, including B Corps.
I work with an international organization called Thrive Networks, and what we do is we use M&A to really create social good and scale social good. We've noticed kind of in our past year as we've ramped this all up, there's really kind of negative connotations towards the word merger and towards the word acquisition in our beautiful nonprofit world. So my question for you is, let me find it. In your opinion, what can we do to lessen the stigma of the word merger so that we can encourage social entrepreneurs to consider more formal collaborations in this sector?
Yeah, maybe there's a question of framing. Maybe one has to talk about nonprofit marriages. You know, that sounds kind of non-traditional marriage.
A lot.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Because M&A does sound very corporate, but I don't know whether, uses a word like collaboration or marriage or something, but I do think that the idea is crucial, and there's so many organizations that, you know, I remember going to Swarthmore once and seeing, meeting these social entrepreneurs and seeing these incredible organizations these students had started doing amazing things all over the world and at home, and I was struck that they had all begun in about the last 2 or 3 years, and I said, well, you know, if I had come 5 years ago, what would I have found? Would there have been nothing? And they said, oh, no, there would have been, you know, the professor said, oh, there would have been exactly the same, this profusion of amazing organizations. And then, you know, they died out, basically. And so there's this incredible array of startups, and then they fade. So I do think that M&A, whatever one calls it, is one way of addressing that.
So a few years ago, my book club and we read Half the Sky, and we were so moved by it that we started a giving circle that now has 50 members. So I want to say thank you for inspiring us. We've donated thousands to women's and girls' causes domestically and overseas, and we get together several times a year, and we hear from different groups.
Good for you.
We've given, thank you. We've given to education. And maternal health. We had Sakina Yakubi from the Afghan Learning Network talk to us. We had Somali Mom talk to our group. So this year we have been focusing on sex trafficking and human trafficking, and I have to say it's been the most, you talked about the joy of coming together and giving, but it's not joyous to discuss, to learn about this topic. It seems so intractable, especially because there's so much money in sex trafficking and human trafficking that it seems something that's hard to get at. And one of the things that we've been trying to figure out is, do you focus on prevention? Do you focus on getting the girls out and giving them new lives? Do you focus on law enforcement? It's really hard. And if you had one of those three areas, prevention, kind of rescuing, or the law enforcement side, prevention being educating the girls, what would you think would be an area to focus on?
You know, I think trafficking is actually a fascinating issue because it addresses so many of these issues and ways to address them. It's so intimately wrapped up in poverty and the pathologies of poverty. And so many of the girls who end up getting trafficked, their mom herself had been in some kind of very vulnerable position and then gave birth to her when she was 15, and then this girl was raised in a very vulnerable environment, didn't get a decent education, and then was preyed upon by a pimp, you know, when she turned 14 or 15, and is wrapped up in substance abuse, and so on. And so it does seem to me, you know, I sort of have this notion that we reach out, we have this deep human yearning for silver bullets. And really, there almost never is a silver bullet, but there is silver buckshot. And there are lots of ways one can make
a
difference.
Your phrase? That is amazing. That's great. Next book,
maybe. Silver buckshot?
I mean, I would, yeah.
Well, you know, I think the ways to address poverty broadly and trafficking in particular are a kind of silver buckshot. You start with the fact that 30% of American teenagers get pregnant by the time they reach 19. And that's a failure of our ability to provide family planning to teenagers. And where there have been programs in St. Louis, in Colorado, to provide long-acting reversible contraceptives to at-risk teenage girls, then the pregnancy rate plunges. And when a 15-year-old girl gets pregnant and has a child, then that is disastrous for her. It usually ends her studying, her schooling, and for the child, who then becomes much more vulnerable to all the problems of poverty later on. So, you know, that is one proven starting point. Then you work with at-risk kids early on, and there is this sort of awkward thing to talk about, this parenting gap, and that, you know, children of professionals have heard 30 million more words by the age of 4 than a child on welfare. They begin to speak at the same time, but the child on professionals has been nurtured and spoken to constantly, is much better prepared for school, has a richer vocabulary. We can indeed address that, and there are programs like Nurse Family Partnership that we talk about Nurse Family Partnership in the book, and it's you know quite incredible. It ends at age 2, begins working with at-risk pregnant women in pregnancy, and then ends at age 2. At age 15, those kids are only half as likely to have been arrested because they got support early on in life. Then, you know, later on, we have this ridiculous system where the police go after the victims, these girls who've been trafficked, and arrest them, and don't go after the pimps and the johns. And the every year, there are something like 100,000 girls who are trafficked into the sex trade in some form. That happens because there is a huge market for them, because there are guys who are buying them. And they are, essentially, is no risk of buying sex with an underage girl. You're as likely to get arrested as you are to be hit by lightning. If that risk were just 5 or 10%, I think it would be enough to deter a lot of people. And you know that's a function of police departments and prosecutors to begin to implement. In the Path Appears, we talk about Nashville, Tennessee, which began a program involving a number of these elements. And you know, it doesn't work perfectly, nothing does. But I think that one can make real progress against that issue, and that it's really, in many ways, kind of a question of political will. So more power to you for doing what you can.
Thank you. And I forgot to mention that in honor of your book, Half the Sky, we called it the One Sky Giving Circle. Mm. Thank you.
Oh, that's great.
Hi, Nick. So you're clearly a wonderful advocate and activist for so many important causes, and you deserve to be congratulated for that. But I do wonder if you haven't abdicated your role as a journalist somewhat. And the case of Somali Mom, who just came up in the previous question, is a good example. As you know, Somali Mom Foundation, which is headed up, or Cheryl Sandberg is on the advisory board, investigated their own namesake and found that she was not what she claimed to be. You've made statements saying, we may never know the truth, I just don't know what to think. But have you tried to get to the bottom of what really happened there? Have you asked the Somali Mom Foundation for that report? And yeah. If not, why not?
So for those who don't know, so Somali Mom is a Cambodian woman who ran a organization, FSEEP and Somali Mom Foundation, addressing trafficking in Cambodia. Early this year, Newsweek ran a cover story alleging that her backstory was essentially fabricated. And the Smelly Mam Foundation here in the U.S. Severed itself from her and I think has now dissolved. Marie Claire has just run a piece that accuses Newsweek, in turn, of having committed all kinds of errors in its report about Smelly Mam and suggesting that it was Newsweek that got it wrong. I've tried to report on this, and I don't know where the truth is. I don't have confidence in Somali's story now, her backstory, but I don't have confidence, I must say, in Newsweek's either.
What about the Smelly Mam Foundation's report, though?
Yeah, I've talked to them repeatedly on and off the record. And I've talked, I spent a lot of time reporting this. I haven't been to Cambodia recently. Somali did some amazing work in the field with those girls. On the other hand, you know, I just don't know whether her backstory.
Will you try to get to the bottom of it, though?
Okay, we should keep moving on to questions.
Yeah.
I'll try to make this quick. So this is alluding to your question regarding social media and the paradigm of television coverage. As a reader, I feel constantly, in a good way, I think for the journalists that are doing it well, bombarded by a lot of crucial stories and relevant content. In today's world, we're so connected and we can share information so freely, it almost feels overwhelming to the point where a reader might feel helpless, as if there's so much happening and they can do so little because of the distance or the actual issue. Mr. Kristoff, as a journalist, what is your advice to readers on how we can get involved, or what's your take on how journalists can help remedy this restlessness?
You know, I think we can talk about cases where there has been an impact. And that's what we try to do in the book. I'm a believer in drops in the bucket. One of the stories we tell that I found particularly moving is that of Ollie Neal, who is this kid from this African-American boy in Arkansas who was very smart but sort of a troublemaker, and he got in trouble shoplifting, he was a loudmouth at school, reduced his teacher to tears, and then one day he's skipping English class, and he goes to the school library run by Mrs. Grady, and he sees this this novel on the shelf by Frank Yerby, an African-American author. And it's got a cover of this woman in sort of a risque top. It's risque by 1957 standards, so it's, you know, presumably she's voluminously addressed by today's standards. And this attracts his eye, and he thinks maybe he'd like to read it. But he's embarrassed at the idea of checking out a book, because he's a tough kid. So he steals it. And so he takes it home and reads it and really likes it. It turns him on to reading. And he returns it a week later, and he sees there's another Frank Yerby novel there. So he steals that, too.
That he hadn't quite seen the week before, right?
He hadn't seen it before. Yeah. That's right. And then he returns it a week later and sees there's another, a third Frank Yerby book that he hadn't noticed before, and steals that. And this happens four times. And this really turns him on to reading. He begins to graduate to other novels, to literary fiction, to current events. He goes to college, goes on to law school, becomes one of Arkansas's first African-American lawyers, becomes a leader in the civil rights movement, eventually a prosecutor, a judge. And so he's a hero of his high school reunions. And at one of these, he tells Mrs. Grady, you know, it's your library that turned my life around. But I have to confess, it's because I stole some of your books. And she says, well, I have a confession as well. I saw you steal that first book. And she said that she had been really angry. She'd been about to confront him. You know, why are you stealing a book when you can just check it out? And then she, in a flash of insight, had understood that he was a tough kid who was embarrassed to be seen checking out a book. So she let him steal it. And then even though he had reduced her to tears earlier, in the hopes that he would like that book and want more, that weekend she drove 70 miles to Memphis to a used bookstore to look for another book by Frank Yerby. The first used bookstore didn't have one by him, so she went to another, and finally another, and for the third or fourth bookstore did. And so she bought that book, put it on the shelf, and she was thrilled when he stole the second book. And then this happened, you know, then when he did that, she went back to Memphis and got another, and so on. And ultimately, it's kind of a reminder that helping people is harder than it looks. It doesn't always work out. But when one can take that risk, and sometimes it plays on dramatically in the lives of others, as Mrs. Grady did for Ollie Neal. Mm. And not everything is scalable. Not everything will solve a problem, but sometimes those drops in the bucket are completely transformative and are truly within our grasp.
Nick, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Early childhood interventions. I've only used 15 seconds, though.
No.
I think the evidence is overwhelming that the brain is developing particularly in the first 1,000 days after conception, and that if you miss that window, it's not that damage can't be undone, but that is when you have the most leverage, and that it's so much cheaper to help support a child early in life than it is to try to deal with a troubled 16-year-old years later. And yet, as a country, we're always, you know, picking the high-hanging fruit and never the low-hanging fruit, which is early childhood education.
Thank you so much on behalf of all of us. I hope you know how many people you have touched and inspired over the years through your work on the ground and through your writing and advocacy. It's so powerful. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.